From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. Also joining us in studio today is Eleanor Holmes Norton. She is a member of the United States House of Representatives. She's a Democrat who represents the District of Columbia. Congresswoman Norton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
If you have questions or comments for Congresswoman Norton, give us a call, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Better yet, you can go to our website, kojoshow.org. Ask a question, make a comment there, and watch the live video stream of the broadcast. Tom, I would like to start by asking Congresswoman Norton about how politics works in Congress, because Senator Barbara Mikulski has secured $390 million for a new FBI headquarters. It's all a part of the spending agreement that was negotiated by Democrats and Republicans in the Congress. But Congresswoman Norton, Democrats are in the minority. Barbara Mikulski in the Senate is in the minority party. How does she nevertheless wangle $390 million that was not included in the original bill in this process? How does that work?
Well, it works that way because Barbara Mikulski is a bipartisan wizard. She was head of the Appropriation Committee in the Senate. Remember, they lost the Senate.
Yep.
For
she's
about
still a ranking member. Yeah, she's ranking still, minority member.
She's ranking minority member. Now, they always get something. Being ranking, I can tell you, having achieved ranking for one of my own committees, it matters. So they're not going to say to the ranking, you don't count. And of course, what most counts at this point, particularly since Barbara is leaving, has already helped to negotiate a very good bill for the region. What matters most to her is Maryland, and she wants to get that headquarters, new headquarters for the FBI in Maryland. Won't be on D.C.
In Prince George's County is where she wants it. I should mention that the money secured in the budget negotiations, however, would be available regardless of where the new headquarters is built. But obviously there are two locations in Prince George's County that are being looked at, and one in Virginia.
Greenbelt and Landover.
But you said
Maryland.
One in Virginia, and that's very important.
Springfield.
Because it shows you that the decision hasn't even been made. And I don't know if I have ever seen anyone get money when the decision of the location hasn't even been made, and that's going to be made by the GSA alone.
Where does this money go? They're going to appropriate money. This is an appropriation. They appropriate the money, but there's nothing in part to spend it on. The money provides for a lot of administrative work to get this done, but the General Services Administration, which is handling the swap, Steny Hoyer suggested a week or so ago that they should forget this cumbersome, convoluted system of getting the developer to commit to a new FBI headquarters in exchange for getting the rights to develop the FBI building downtown on Pennsylvania Avenue, and just sell the FBI building outright so that can move on while they get ready for the new space. Where were you on that?
Well, frankly, as long as they get off and we can put commercial there, I don't much care. But I think what Steny was saying was that the swap really isn't enough to secure a campus. And what he didn't say is even if you sell it, it wouldn't be enough to secure a campus. But at least you'd have a concrete amount of money in your hand. Then, of course, they'd have to go to the Congress of all people, places, and ask for the rest of the money. And that's really the holdup.
I think I don't understand one thing. I'd like to ask this. You know, given the FBI and its 11,000 employees, and given all the efforts you've done to keep alive the idea of the Homeland Security Agency being consolidated on the West Campus of St. Elizabeth, I don't understand why the FBI can't be stay in the city. I know the city seems to have made maybe a half-hearted effort. Does the FBI, I've never heard an FBI official, not one, say they want to move to some exurb. I have not heard one FBI official say.
Is he fighting a battle that's already over?
Like, but he's spoken like a true Washingtonian,
well,
isn't he?
But I don't understand why it can't be on the FBI, on the campus over there, and get that going. I mean, all those historic buildings have to be redone. There is space, as you well know.
Oh, well, that's not a historic building. That's just a monstrosity on Pennsylvania Avenue.
No, I'm saying, no, the buildings on St. Elizabeth are historic buildings. Oh. You gave me a great tour there several years ago when we went through there. But there's land to build a new headquarters. I just don't understand why it's got caught up. Is it because Barbara Mikulski wants it in the suburbs?
No, there was a competition, to be fair.
Yeah.
D.C. did propose a site. D.C. did propose a site near the Anacostia. When you say it was half-hearted, maybe it was. It made the big try. I'm not sure that site was large enough. What is sure is that you don't move unless you consolidate everything. So they're not only located there; they're located all around the region.
Yeah. All right, they've got 20-something different buildings
exactly.
Or something like that. It's huge.
I'd like to get to another issue quickly, and that
to stop talking about this.
And that is what it seems to me is an embarrassment to the District of Columbia. On the one hand, there's the news that former mayoral candidate, Busboys and Poets owner Andy Shalal is going to be the chair of the Workforce Investment Council. That is a body usually led by somebody in the private industry that's really supposed to be overseeing all of the federal monies that go for job training in D.C. But it would appear that, A, that position has been vacant since April, and that, B, the city has found itself on a list of the federal government, maybe the only jurisdiction on that list, that indicates that the city has not properly spent the money that we've been getting for job training in a city where we deplore the increasing gap between the rich and the poor, in a city where everybody who is an elected official or an appointed leader seems to say that should be one of the most important priorities of the city is job training. Why and how have we dropped the ball?
Well, I hope Andy Shalal, who was going to run for that large council seat against Vincent Orange. I started to say Vincent Gray, but that could be possible, too. Vincent Orange, but he has decided he's gotten this job. Some people joke that he got this job so he wouldn't run. But Andy's a good businessman. He's opened several stores around shops, cafes around the region. But, you know, I've gone on many rants on this program about how the Department of Employment Services and the Workforce Investment Council, they cannot tell us the most simple things. How many people have been trained? How many people have gotten jobs for at least 6 months? How many people are, or how many programs are there? How many contracts are there? It's really, it needs major work. And I'm hoping that Andy, if he's in this job, and he takes it seriously as he has done everything else he's done in his professional life, will finally get the money out of the contractor's hands and onto the real work of getting people training. I just hope that he'll just be as aggressive on that as he possibly can.
And get us off that list. We're the only city on that list of being a high-risk partner in job training
Millions
and employment
of dollars.
Programs. This is your hometown, Congresswoman.
Yeah, but that is a city. And I must say, this is the first I've heard that they're not spending some federal money as hard as it is to get it. Some would say better not to spend it than spend it the way they have been spending it. You know, so you've got to find where the jobs are. You got to make the link to employers, and I hope that's what is the reason for the pause, and I'll call it a pause, because after a while you lose that money.
Well, you know, the Department of Employment Service has a very nice building on Minnesota Avenue, Northeast Washington.
Congressman Norton,
that ought to be putting some jobs out.
You've spent so much of your life advocating for D.C. to get voting representation in Congress. We'll talk more about where that's heading in a little while, but there are serious concerns about the democracy that D.C. residents do get to participate in locally, and whether our last mayoral election was ultimately swayed by prosecutors who implicated Vincent Gray in a campaign corruption scheme weeks before a primary without ever charging him later. How did you react to the news that the new U.S. attorney will not be filing charges against former Mayor Gray after all this time?
Well, I think along with the rest of the city, we wanted it to be settled one way or the other. And the new U.S. attorney said that he would settle it by the end of the year, and he did. So it's more to be done because we don't know about all those people who pleaded guilty. But at least he's got it off our plate, and we can go on.
There are six people who have pled guilty in some connection to the shadow campaign that Jeffrey Thompson ran, including Jeffrey Thompson, one of the six. They now have court dates extending all the way to July, where they will go into court and will finally be sentenced. And at that point, we hope to learn even more details that will be filed by the prosecutors on the full picture of what the shadow campaign was. But Vince Gray, as we said last week, is off the hook for this as of now.
You recommended that a new U.S. attorney be appointed from one from outside the D.C. office. How much of that recommendation was about the U.S. attorney's investigation of corruption in general and the former mayor in particular?
Kojo, since that was the only case anybody knew, they figured that that was the case that decided who would be U.S. attorney. So I welcome the opportunity to use this occasion to tell exactly how it happens. We should be very pleased that the Democratic presidents have treated us as if we have senators. They've given us what is called senatorial courtesy for officials who are federal officials, U.S. attorney, federal judges. We now have federal bench of stars. I'm talking about the district court. And they are the most diverse bench in the United States.
And this is the largest U.S. attorney's office in the country.
Now, when it goes to the U.S. attorney, it's the largest because it has local matters. It wouldn't be the largest else otherwise. No. We, of course, have senatorial courtesy for that. Now, I, of course, recommended Mr. Machen, and I recommended him after my commission, consisting of residents from every ward, gave me a list of three names, and I selected him. And it must be said here, he did an awfully good job of getting at corruption because he brought down several members of the council. I don't know
three.
If that's I don't know if that's ever been done before. But he resigned. And
after
this,
5 years, which was a very long time for a prosecutor.
And even in this city. And here was the one case that anybody knew about left undone. So if you're in the public, you think, well, that case is going to decide who's going to be the U.S. attorney. I had to be really careful to use my background as a lawyer and to use the criteria I usually use. Now, my background as a lawyer tells me the U.S. attorney does not move on you until he's sure he can get you. So I was not bothered by the fact that it took a long time, except for the long time it took. So what I did after getting a recommendation, and my commission was split, they didn't give me a specific recommendation. So I talked to the same people I talk to all the time, judges, sitting judges, people in the office now, people who used to be in the office, former U.S. attorneys, in other words, people who know the office, who know these two people who were
Eric Holder. Did you talk to Eric Holder?
We not directly, but we did have some communication with the big office, of course.
Two people who were up were Vincent Cohen Jr. and Channing Phillips.
That's
also a junior.
And of course, by the way, I don't know either of these two men very well, except by reputation. And isn't it interesting? Both of them had almost precisely the same credentials. They'd both been principal U.S. attorney at second in command. It's true that Channing Phillips had been there a long time because he's been there a very long time. Both had a record to boast of, so it was not an easy decision.
What was the deciding factor?
The deciding factor was the recommendations of the people I talked to.
Is that a temperament recommendation or just...
A what?
A temperament or...
No,
or
they,
not
no.
connected.
They have
to
the
that?
Same kind of temperaments.
Okay.
It has to do with their records, and it was difficult for these people too. Although they too were split.
Well, you know, you, given your long career as a politician in the city, have close ties with many people. Have you filed for re-election yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Should announce here.
You know, Mayor Gray, the prosecutor said in a very simple statement, they didn't say he's innocent, he didn't do anything. They simply announced that they didn't think there'd be any likely, the evidence was likely insufficient, was a quoted phrase, likely insufficient evidence to move forward with any other charges against any other people. So Mayor Gray is off the hook legally for this. He's done, he's told Kojo this past few days, he is seriously looking at running for the council, either Ward 7 or at large. What is your thoughts as a leader of the city? Should the mayor get back in? I know it's his decision, but would you advise him one way or the other? And would you support
him? Well, first
him?
Let me say something about what you just said. Because I think that what the U.S. attorney said, everyone should understand. I tried to say it earlier when I said, if the U.S. attorney indicts you, you're going to get it. He doesn't miss. Look at the former governor of Virginia. Took a long time, but they certainly did get him. Now, maybe they weren't. It's in the won't. It's in the Supreme Court. I think this U.S. attorney looked and said, is it basically a 99% chance that I'm going to prevail? And it has to be just that high because his reputation, imagine losing this case, where it would have gone. And where would he have gotten his jurors?
Right.
12 people from the District of Columbia. So it's a tough case for him to decide whether to move forward. Now, your second question was...
I kind of lost it. Oh, did you support Mayor Gray if he runs?
Oh, I have no idea. Who's he going to run?
But I would say, I said in my newspaper column this week that prosecutor sources and defense attorney sources say that the reason they couldn't go forward was the other five people who have pled guilty could provide corroborating information about what happened, but that Jeffrey Thompson was the sole source, or the key person would have to go before the jury, and that they decided he was not credible enough to go. And he is a...
Do you think they decided he was not credible enough to go because of the nature of the plea deal that he had struck with the U.S.
attorney?
No,
the plea deal was perfectly fine because he provided the key information. The problem was he couldn't provide that information, according to my sources, to a jury. And we still do not know why Jeffrey Thompson was not a credible witness. You know, people who commit murder and fraud and all kinds of things testify in cases.
No, it's not based on his temperament.
No, I'm not his temperament. For some reason, they decided that as much as he knew about the shadow campaign,
he wasn't credible.
He wasn't going to be credible
because
before a jury.
What was at stake on both sides? What was at stake on his side was what he had to say if he became the key witness about the mayor, and what was at stake on the mayor's side was his view, which is now said and made clear, that was not the case. So what does the jury do with that?
Well, I just think the credibility of the witness, they'll look more deeply at the two people, and they had a problem with Jeffrey Thompson beyond his orchestrating the shadow campaign.
Mayor Gray took a few shots at his successor this week and the now-defunct Political Action Committee that was set up to support her freshback. WAMU's Patrick Madden reported this week that the power company Exelon actually hired Freshpack's chair to lobby D.C. government to support its acquisition of Pepco. What are your thoughts about that? And now that the General Services Administration has weighed in against the proposed deal, what are your thoughts about both of those things?
Well, on the deal, I think it's good that the mayor decided to get rid of the PAC because apparently he was wearing two hats at one point at the same time, and I'm sure she wouldn't have wanted to be implicated in that. So to get that off the table was a good decision. By the way, this is the kind of thing that's done in Congress all the time. So, you know, they may look over at Congress and say, hey, look, this is what the big boys on the Hill do. Do not follow the Congress. I would never have one of those PACs. They'll get you in more trouble than they'll help you out.
Your friends are your most dangerous people.
Oh, they are. You don't know what they're doing, especially one of these super PACs, because they can't talk to you. Now, you also said something.
The General Services Administration.
Now, here is something interesting. I think what residents don't realize is who our biggest ratepayer is.
It's the General Services Administration, the federal government, the federal taxpayers.
And this is why we get water. I go very hard at the federal government to give us, this year we got $14 million for our water and sewer authority. But GSA hasn't been involved before. And we've had Public Service Commissioner come up, for example, for increases. Well, those are little increases that you expect every few years.
Right. Something tolerable.
This isn't about an increase. This is about a totally new company, a conglomerate of sorts. And they decided first that they would have something to say. We don't know what they said, but they wouldn't testify. Mm-hmm. Now they have said, wait a minute, we're the ones to pay the big money, and the way in which, and here's where everybody has to be careful, D.C. residents got a break is they offloaded it on the taxpayers of the United States of America. So we've got to say something. Now, what they will say, I think, will not affect taxpayers here. It may affect Exelon and Pepco. Well, if somebody has to absorb it, why does it have to be the biggest ratepayer? Why can't it be the company itself?
It's a little troubling to some people that there's this ongoing Pepco Exelon public relations campaign on Facebook, on social media elsewhere, on newspaper ads and radio ads, talking about what a great deal it is. But it's the Public Service Commission, three members chaired by Betty Ann Kane, a former council member, who have to make this decision. And now you have GSA saying, wait, you're sticking us with the bill. And you have other people saying that Exelon is just going to reap the cash value out of Pepco to pay for its other operations and its own, and the Pepco shareholders are going to be wealthy from the deal. It just doesn't sound like this was handled very well.
And now,
if I were just a regular citizen,
not surprisingly, Public Citizen has weighed in against the deal also.
Yes, they have. I mean, it just seems that
so we don't have any experience with this kind of deal. Most of what the public service deals with is small potatoes compared with this.
But, you know, the Post editorial today on the Pepco-Exelon merger and FreshPak's involvement as a lobbyist, and his name's Earl Chico Horton, the third, I think. The Post asked some good questions on the editorial. It said the mayor ought to disclose. I think the mayor says she didn't talk to Horton about this deal. But the Post, which is very favorable to the mayor.
About which deal?
About the Pepco Exelon deal. Post says Norton should disclose.
Norton is in the studio.
There's so many names that I'm getting mis- The Bowser. Post editorial urged Mayor Bowser to disclose emails or other records to show that nothing was done improperly between.
Well, you know what? Let me just say something about a pack like that. The PAC, I would be amazed if the PAC talks with the mayor.
But she went to their, she was a lead fundraiser.
Yeah,
for
that's
them.
The way they work. You can go to one of their events, but you cannot coordinate with them. So
They're not obligated to share the information about what they're doing.
I don't think they, I think they could have gotten what they wanted without speaking directly to anybody.
But the best part of the problem, though, Mr. Horton, being the lobbyist for Exelon, can go to Kojo, if he's a business leader in town, and says, we want you to support this. And the business leader knows, well, he's got the right, he's got to the right arm of the mayor. He can influence the mayor more than he can.
Now, I want you to know this is why so many of us against the Supreme Court decision, except that now it comes to the local level. And the mayor, I think, has decided she doesn't want to have anything to do with it to get you in more trouble than it helps you out.
Yeah, I've told
you. Got to take a short break because, as you know, this is the last day of our end-of-year membership campaign. So we're going to take a short break and do that, and then we'll continue our discussion on the Politics Hour with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. She's a member of the United States House of Representatives. She's a Democrat who represents the district. And Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. You can still call us, though, 800-433-8850 if you have questions or comments for the Congresswoman. Watch the live video stream at kojoshow.org. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picoult and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at DianeRehm.org/bookclub.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour with Tom Sherwood. He's our resident analyst, reporter for NBC4, and a columnist for the current newspapers. Our guest is Eleanor Holmes Norton, member of the United States House of Representatives, a Democrat who represents the District of Columbia. And on to what's been going on in the Congress, Congresswoman Norton. We got a tweet from Charles who says, I appreciate Representative Norton's support for ending the drug war. She co-sponsored the cannabis legislation bill, H.R. 1013. What did we get out of the budget agreement?
Well, I think there was some dread that because we had the first Republican, all-Republican House and Senate, first Republican Senate in 8 years, that we'd be taken to the cleaners. They tried. But in the end, we found very good people to negotiate with, including, for money, some very good appropriators who were fair to us. The House seldom is fair, but for example, DC TAG. This is a tuition access grant program that is more than double college attendance. We've been kept at 30 million dollars, but I was pleased to get that because the House kept cutting it. I was dependent on a Democratic Senate. This time, it's not $30 million, it's $40 million. President had put that in his budget. For the first time in about 5 years, we were able to get an increase. That means kids can go to college. I was the ranking member of the subcommittee that wrote the big, it's one of the biggest appropriations in the Congress, authorizations in the Congress. It's for your streets, highways, and transit. For D.C., we got an almost 25% increase in transit because for the first time, I got us included in an urban portion for older transit systems. That's an almost 25% for WMATA when it most needs it, about a 10% increase for roads and bridges. This is obviously very important for the for our city at a time when its streets, like the streets across the United States, are crumbling. Department of Homeland Security, that thing will never be built. Huge appropriation. President had put it in. Whether or not we get it from the House and Senate, nothing from the House. The Senate, the Republican Senate, talked to them long and hard about how you are more than a little pregnant now. Let's get this done. It's cost us billions more than it would have had we built it straight away. Guaranteed to be finished now. The Secretary himself, with almost a thousand of his staff, will be going into the center building, and that's the next thing up.
Tell us about the one good thing for commuters. The in the past, there's been a federal subsidy for, I think, federal workers. If you park your car, you get something like $250 a month of a commuter fee. But if you ride Metro, you got $130 a month. And now Metro riders will get the same kind of benefit.
Yeah, we had this terrible period. When, as it turns out, you got more for in tax benefits, now we're talking, for bringing your car and parking than you got for riding Metro, because the Republican Congress just cut us down and said, well, you can't get any more for one than for the other. I put in a bill. That bill must be at least 5 years old. Got through this time with some help, by the way, from the Senate, so that now we don't have this disparity. And this comes at a time when Metro needs the help. 25% reduction in ridership over the last 5 years. So they don't need, by the way, we got the full $150 million for the eighth straight year. Remember, 10 years? This is something very important
to us.
That's
for the capital budget for.
Exactly.
To fix the escalators and all the other things.
With all those other things that are breaking down again because it's an old system now.
Would you support? I was talking to Jack Evans and to other members of the city. They think that the federal government ought to contribute to the operating budget, the annual operating budget of Metro, just like Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. do, $300 million a year. Should the federal government also contribute to the operating budget? And then maybe, and Jack and others have said, if they did that, maybe we could reduce fares for a while in order to get people to ride the thing.
Yeah, now let's make sure everybody understands the three jurisdictions contribute to the operating budget. But who is the biggest user of that budget? The federal government. Shut down Metro, you must shut down the federal government. Now, they've got a person or two, maybe one, who is on the governing board. Mm-hmm. And they do contribute something, but it contributes to everybody. They do contribute $150 million, for example, we just discussed. Nobody else gets that. But operating means year by year they do not contribute. And so many of us indeed support a portion of the operating budget coming from the federal government, which has, in a real sense, the most to lose.
How do you persuade a Republican Congress, which tends many of its members, to run against Washington, D.C., to do that?
You raise a very important point. It was very hard for us to get that $150 million for capital improvements because they just saw it as something for us instead of something for the federal government. And that is, fortunately, here we have four senators and a congressional delegation to help us. And we're going to keep pressing this one because we don't think WMATA can continue to support itself the way it's going.
If the city wants to be a state, why doesn't the city pay for its own judges? Why do we still have to have the president appoint our judges and spend, I think it's about $150 million to run the U.S. Attorney's local office and prosecution? Why can't we have our own judge and justice system in the city, which would show that we are, you know, we're big guys now, that we can run ourselves? The Congress originally didn't want a black person to be the police chief and all these other things, but we're 40, 50 years past that. Why can't we have a full local government?
We can, and that's the way we want it. Everybody wants us to be the 51st state, then we'll pay for everything. If anything, we've asked the federal government under the Revitalization Act to pay for more things. They took off our hands, for example, when the district had a control board. Both of you will remember that. we said, the council and the mayor said, take some of the state functions off us. For example, where do our prisoners go? Our inmates go. They go to the Bureau of Prisons. So if the district becomes a 51st state, it's going to have to take all that back. It's going to have to create its own judicial system. These are Article I judges now. By the way, we used to pay for them, and still we couldn't appoint them. At least we said, look, as long as we're not going to pay for them, as long as we're not going to appoint them, you pay for them. So it is true that statehood is not cost-free, and that's what the residents want. That's why we continue this time. Momentum is very important here to get co-sponsors. We got original co-sponsors, almost 100 members of the House, not just me, sponsoring it myself, and then go get people. Because if you don't continue the momentum when you're not in control, it'll be too late when you finally get control to start afresh.
And I know you have a huge civil rights background. I don't think we can have you on a program and not let you talk first about police body cameras, the extraordinary turmoil in the police departments across the country. This city has largely avoided some of that. This week, the mayor very quickly released some police video of someone who died in police custody of private security people, so that people wouldn't have any doubts. There wouldn't be any. Just looking at Baltimore, looking at Chicago, looking around, given your long history in civil rights, is the city on the right path? Are we doing the right thing? Should we be doing more?
I'm so glad that the city got ahead of where most cities were with body cameras, for example, that they have released this video. Very, very important. You know, I've got two things in this appropriation, in the surface transportation grants for people who want to deal with racial profiling. Also, we have now language, my language that I got in the appropriation for highways, saying that there is an obligation on the part of states not to make sure that federal money is not used for racial profiling. So that's kind of two ways to go at it. But the district does not need to be hoisted on this batard, and getting in front of it was, I think, what a good progressive city does.
Members of Congress tried to use a spending bill this week to block retail sales of marijuana in the district, despite the fact that a year ago, D.C. voters approved an initiative legalizing possession and certain kinds of consumption of marijuana here. What did you make of what your colleagues tried to do here?
Well, they tried to keep us block possession as well, but I found a loophole in that, so you can possess. But, Kojo, look at the anomaly or hypocrisy or outrageousness, call it what you want to, of being able to possess, but then having to go to the illegal market in order to get it. So these are out of sync with one another. So I'm still trying to get that off of our backs, that block, and that's on our appropriation bill. Shouldn't be in the Congress in the first place because it's only our money.
Spending bill also continues the longstanding ban on the use of local and federal funds to pay for abortions for low-income women in the district. But it's my understanding that this bill will allow you and other young people to resume sledding on Capitol Hill. How did that come about?
Yeah, but that's not a trade-off.
sledding. Not nearly.
All of a sudden, the Capitol Police decided that they were going to enforce a 100-year-old bill that apparently said, long before any of us were around, that you can't sled on Capitol Hill. First, people went out anyway, and wow, good for you, D.C. residents, and sled.
No, we tried to get you to come out and go down the international
It would have, and that's why I didn't do it. So first they just didn't arrest people. But then we were very afraid that maybe they start arresting people. So I got language in the appropriation that says, look, we're not going to go through the trouble of going to the House and Senate to get this repealed. So we direct you, do not enforce that 100-year-old law. So, hey, wait for the first snow, then go to it, D.C.
What do you make of Senator Rand Paul's recent efforts to attach measures to roll back D.C.'s handgun restrictions to other Senate measures?
You know, Kojo, they tried every time, but watch out when there are three Republicans running for the Senate. Rand Paul ratcheted it up, tried it in two different ways. This libertarian who's supposed to believe that the federal government ought to be out of the lives of
people. Well, you mentioned he's running for president, yes.
Yeah, but once you had Rubio, Cruz, and not all on the same bill, but all trying to use the District of Columbia to keep them off in the final omnibus bill.
And local activist Adam Eidinger was arrested and charged with unlawful entry at a House hearing earlier this year about a measure to block a local anti-discrimination measure. His trial resulted in a hung jury, and he'll be retried next year. You have said you'll testify. How come?
I was willing to testify before, but they thought, I think for good reason, that they probably wouldn't need the testimony of either Adam or me. So they got a hung jury. Now, I say to myself, why are they going ahead with this? They know that some of us saw it. They saw that Adam didn't stand up.
There was a protest at that hearing in which some people stood up and they were, as a result, asked to leave. Adam Eidinger said he did not stand up, but nevertheless was being asked to leave and refused to do so, as a result was arrested.
And I was sitting right there and could see the others who stood up. They had signs because they were from D.C. Vote. He did not. And he had to be carried out, because he exercised what looked to be your First Amendment rights to sit in the Congress, hear, listen, did not speak. Now they're going to try him again. I said, why would they try him again? They had a hung jury. Maybe it's because the Congress, you know, was involved in this. This time, if I am called, since I was an eyewitness, I will certainly testify what I saw. And all I can say is this. To whatever poor U.S. attorney, if they do decide to go along with this, it'll be an assistant U.S. attorney. Do not envy you to get jurors who will convict a fellow Washingtonian for sitting in the Congress to hear what they have to say. I don't envy you for having to do that, but I will certainly testify what I saw, and I will testify truthfully.
Afraid that's about all the time we have. Ellen Holmes Norton is a member of the United States House of Representatives. She's a Democrat who represents the District of Columbia. Congresswoman Norton, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you all. I should mention, Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers, but he's going to stick around for a few months.
I'm on vacation next week.
Thank you all for listening. Anyway. I'm Kojo Namdi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.